Good morning. Thank you all for coming. Wonderful attendance here. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so all participants, please speak clearly. For people who want to watch or listen to the meeting in Spanish, we have Spanish interpretation services that are available in person and through our Zoom platform. Instructions are shown on the side. Please let the interpreters or Deidre know if you need assistance. Members of the public who wish to observe or to address the board may join the meeting at the notice physical location or may use the Zoom application to address the board from a remote location. For people who want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and the password you received from the clerk. If you've not already received the meeting ID and password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/North Coast. Click on the December 4 to 5, 2024 board meeting button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with the Zoom login information. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card available on the tables outside the boardroom and give it to the clerk. For those in the meeting, Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. The clerk will unmute you when it is your turn to address the board. We will call each commenter by name and then unmute each commenter. I would also like to ask those who have provided a contact name to please state your name for the record before you speak. There is a normal 5-minute time limit for each commenter. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and or when your time is up. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are called upon during public comment. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the meeting or continue. All right, so we're gonna take time to say the Pledge of Allegiance. If you would join me, please. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Okay, board members, do you have anything to report? Any communications, meetings, things you participated in, comments? Okay. Is Dee Dee online?
Yes, Dee Dee's online.
I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see everyone. I'll start my report. Introduce myself, Dee Dee Diadamo, State Water Board member and liaison to Region 1. And I'll start the report with some information regarding a community meeting that was held in Mendocino, attended by our Division of Drinking Water and Division of Financial Assistance. The Mendocino City Community Services District that currently provides sewer service hosted the meeting. And at the meeting, technical assistance providers presented information regarding a potential project for drinking water. And at this stage, the focus is on source water and study findings to the community. and answering questions. Staff that attended indicated that there does seem to be interest in the development of a regional drinking water system, which is, I think, very promising in light of some of the challenges that the community has had during drought periods. There seems to be also an understanding of the potential benefits of having a community water system. But there were concerns raised regarding potential impacts in the Big River watershed. I don't know anything more than that, but other than to just highlight it to you all that those concerns were raised. The next steps is that the technical assistance provider will be making final revisions and issue a final study regarding source water in January. And after that, the next major milestone is a public meeting planned for April of 2025 to present an engineering report on project alternatives. Moving on, I know you're all very closely following Klamath River and dam renewal and water quality, but I'll just say that water quality has improved. And there are continuing with KRRC monthly grab samples for nutrients, suspended sediment concentration, and other constituents, and submittal of those results with their monthly water quality monitoring reports as per the 2022 water quality monitoring plan. And then moving on to some of the targeted efforts that we have on flows, minimum in-stream flows for fishery protection on the Scott and Shasta. Because of some of the good precipitation events that we saw, levels are high enough in both the Scott and Shasta watershed, so no curtailments are currently in effect in either watershed because of the high flows. Our board did have a workshop on October 16th, at which time we directed staff to bring back some recommendations on next steps. Recall that those watersheds are under an emergency regulation that has an expiration. It's only in effect for 1 year. And I believe the current regulation will expire at the end of January. And so in order to not have a lapse in coverage, I do expect that our staff will be bringing a potential resolution for the continuation of that emergency regulation, probably at our first meeting in January. But the question really becomes, what about the long term? Because this is just, you know, not really the best tool to be addressing fishery impacts in that watershed. There seems to be, you know, ongoing support, definitely. I know that your staff has been quite helpful. Some of the tribes in that area have been really pushing for this. But we do continue to have concerns by the agricultural community about the long-term economic impact. And so really the best way to address all of these issues is to just go through our standard process, which we've directed our staff to be not just working on sort of that temporary fix of the emergency regs, but to bring back to our board a scientific basis report for baseline minimum flows and to have it peer reviewed, which is something that during an emergency regulatory process we're not able to do, and then initiate an analysis of implementing long-term baseline flows in those watersheds, and at which time we'd be able to consider the impacts on fishing and agriculture and associated indirect impacts. So I'm really looking forward to kicking off that process this next year. Yesterday at our board meeting, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Safe Drinking Water program, the Safe Drinking Water Act, which was adopted on December 16th, 50 years ago. Our board had a really interesting presentation about the history of the act. We all learned something about sort of the history and how things evolved through time. And it was just really an opportunity for us to pause and look at how far we've come and how far we still need to go. And we received a resolution from Senator Laird's office in commemoration of the 50th anniversary. We've been pretty busy the last few months and continue to be so, focusing on the draft Sacramento Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. We've had targeted workshops. Just this week, we had a workshop where we focused on the Healthy Rivers and Landscape Voluntary Agreements is what they're also called, really focusing on accounting methods for the restoration commitments that have been made through those agreements, so that as we go forward and continue further deliberations, we will have a better sense of exactly what is being provided and the analysis for the benefits that are expected. We will also have a workshop next week that I'm really looking forward to, where we will have similar focused discussions on accounting for the flow commitments that are contained within those agreements. We also have included in the program of implementation of what we've rolled out. Staff has posed some questions about tribal or cultural use, and so possible designation. And so I'm really looking forward to, we're going to have a targeted workshops. Let's see here. I'm looking for the date. I'm sorry, I should be better organized here. I think this is a topic that you're probably going to want to follow, but I'm not getting the exact date, but we have an upcoming workshop also on tribal beneficial use or cultural use. You know, I'm going to follow up with an email to your executive officer with that date so that you'll have the exact date. And then comments are due on the 30th of January regarding some alternatives that are under consideration. And currently the comment period is the 19th of December for the program of implementation. So we have two comment periods for the Bay Delta plan. Another area where we've had some targeted focus on fishery protection is in the mill deer and antelope creeks that are important salmon bearing tributaries to the Sacramento River. And our board will be, or our staff will be conducting a workshop on solicitation of input for the development of a scientific basis report pertaining to in-stream flows on those three important salmon-bearing creeks. Again, similar approach to what we're taking on Scott and Shasta, looking at tools other than just the emergency, you know, temporary one-year emergency regulations, looking at taking long-term action on those creeks as well. Our administrative hearing office continues hearings on two important petitions that are before our board, Sites Projects Authority petition for the Sites Reservoir Project and the Delta Conveyance Project. And I would just encourage you all to look at the websites if those matters are of interest to you, so that you can follow on the YouTube channel. And then lastly, I think good progress on sustainable groundwater management. We have, you know, the six basins that have been turned over to our board from the Department of Water Resources. We placed two of them on probation, and the third one that was up for consideration of probation, the Cahuilla sub-basin, they had a hearing scheduled for the 7th of January, and the Groundwater Sustainability Agencies submitted updated plans to us, and our staff did sort of a cursory review and determined that at this point, not seeing any major red flags. And so the decision was made to cancel the hearing give staff the opportunity to just really comb through the proposal and make sure that, you know, we really understand what the commitments are and that there is an analysis that shows sustainability within the timeframe prescribed. And so fingers crossed, you know, I think this is an example of how an act that was adopted 10 years ago really has shown progress and improvement for those areas that are not able to show that. Our board has the capacity to step in and issue probationary designation. And within a 1 year period after that's done, if an updated improved plan is not submitted, then we have the ability to take over management on a temporary basis. But just having communities knowing that that possibility exists, I think has helped some of these basins to rethink things and, you know, do the work that needs to be done on modeling and technical studies and all that to submit something that actually can show a roadmap towards sustainability. So I'm really looking forward to receiving a more detailed update from that sub-basin once staff has the opportunity to go through the report. And then lastly, the Safe and Affordable Fund for Equity and Resilience, the Safer Drinking Water Program. We have an advisory group that'll hold its last meeting of 2024, today. And this meeting will occur virtually for those that are interested in following that, can go to the website. That's all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Dee Dee, thank you so much for your thoughtful report, and I jotted down a few things about the outreach that you and your staff have given to the North Coast. The outreach that you do, that this agency does, is all about building trust with people and communities that have had a long-standing distrust of government agencies. You're helping disadvantaged communities, and in light, and I'm going to roll this into the chair's report, in light of the climate change that we've experienced. In Healdsburg, in my backyard, we experienced 22 inches of rain in 2 days, in 48 hours, and I had never seen that before. 10, 15 years ago, when the climate models were being developed, and there were several, they predicted this. They predicted that these rain events would come in a short period of time, high amounts in a short period of time, and then dry weather. Hopefully we won't get dry weather, but nevertheless, when I made these comments to friends and colleagues about these models, they couldn't believe it. It just sounded too far-fetched. But weather patterns are changing, and these models do predict fairly well within reason. But the effect that climate change is having is, with fires and floods, utility rates are high. Affordability is becoming a little more difficult, and what does the family do? The families buy less food, buy less nutritious food, and so I'll ask you all, in light of climate change and what you could do, is to support the food banks, the Redwood Empire Food Bank, for example. I'm a volunteer as an agronomist with in Healdsburg, the Farm to Fight Hunger, the Jardín de la Comunidad, and now a project with Geyserville High School to create vegetable gardens that involves the community, students, to help with slightly, I guess, but to help with food insecurity, to work against food insecurity and help bring kids along, maybe give them a few skills, give them a summer job. But the climate change is real, and we're experiencing it, and it has a big effect on our pocketbooks. And what you're doing by conducting this outreach in our northern region, thank you very much. Our coastal region needs it too, but it builds trust, and that's essential. It's essential for our communities. It's essential for our disadvantaged communities that they trust those who have the ability to help them. I just want to thank you, Dee Dee, and your staff.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Chair. My sense is that we still have a long way to go, but it's been, I think, a tremendous opportunity to serve on a board that has growing awareness and sensitivities to, just building those relationships and our need to do a better job. And I think that it's the combination of commitment through resolutions like and actions like the racial equity plan, the climate change resolution that, we took on at the state board, and then under your leadership and the leadership of the other regional boards, really looking at not a one size fits all, but what works best in your communities, and then circling back around and having that feedback loop with state boards so we can learn from each other and grow. So it's been a tremendous time of change. And as you say, we're really in a crisis situation with climate change and these many challenges that we have, but through that trust building, we can better glean where we have opportunities to meet those challenges. So thank you for your comments.
Jake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi there, Jake McKenzie from Rohnert Park. I was curious when the board met yesterday and you were discussing the Sacramento River Bay Delta situation, where there was any discussion by the board in terms of the incoming federal administration. I've been reading in the media about the possibility of changes being, I don't know whether demanded is the right word or how it should be phrased, but was there any discussion of the special session of the newly seated legislature and what actions might be suggested by the state of California to with possible confrontations with an incoming new executive branch in Washington, D.C.?
That's a good question. So the Bay Delta plan, just backing up a bit, we are required under the Clean Water Act to update the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. Normally, that would be the role of regional boards, but because we have several regional boards that are within the Bay Delta watershed, this has historically been an action that the state board has undertaken. What is required for us to have triennial reviews. The last review that we had, the last action that we took in the Bay Delta watershed was just for a portion of it. In 2018, we adopted updated water quality standards for the San Joaquin River component, but putting off the Sacramento piece because it was just too much to undertake all at one time. And so here we are many years later, finally poised to take action sometime soon. Prior to that, though, we hadn't taken action since 2006, at which time we received, the board, I wasn't on the board at the time, but we received information about the significant collapse of some of the fisheries in the Bay Delta watershed and the need to be looking at water quality for all beneficial uses, really focusing on the needs of fisheries. So that was in 2006. As you all know, this is a very challenging undertaking, and there are many different components if we were to look at, water quality in the watershed and really looking at a comprehensive approach here. so that it's not a targeted species by species approach, which can be, you know, really challenging in a watershed this size, but looking at more comprehensive actions that can be taken. And however, our process is not the only game in town. So I think what you might be referring to is the biological opinions and some of the activity that occurred in the previous Trump administration, at which time a biological opinion that had been updated under the Obama administration, then once the Trump administration came in and, you know, sort of peeled that back and then provided an update, updated biological opinion under the Trump administration. And so it really has been not our process, but an important consideration or component as we move forward and deliberate on our process. And so it remains to be seen what the incoming administration will do, because there is an updated proposal that is out there, but it's hard to predict what's going to happen. Not being involved directly in some of the legislative deliberations, of course, because that's the state legislature, and of course, you know, the governor working with the legislature. I think at this point, the focus is making sure that funding is available so that in the event that, you know, these or other actions are taken that are contrary to the strong environmental protection and other policy areas in California, that there would be funding available for the state of California to challenge those areas that are contrary to adopted policies that we have in California, whether that be through litigation or other means. So that's all I can really comment on at this time. But just know that I think one component of what we are considering is in this proposal for healthy rivers and landscapes, that is not that is not a proposal that we developed. It's a proposal for an alternative approach that was brought to us by public water agencies, along with the support of, you know, the governor and the secretary of Cal EPA and the secretary of the Natural Resources Agency. So we are reviewing that proposal as an independent board. We're reviewing that proposal along with what our staff had rolled out back in 2019 through a scientific basis report for a flow-only approach. And so really what's on the table for us to consider, and this is why it's taking so much time, is comparing a flow-only approach where additional flow is required in the Bay Delta watershed, versus this healthy rivers and landscape approach, which is a flow and non-flow combination. Not as much flow as what's under the flow only approach, but more of, you know, sort of targeted functional flow along with restoration activities and commitments, adaptive management, science, governance. So a much more comprehensive program. In the event that program, let's just say, if we go forward as a board and determine that the healthy rivers and landscape approach is a better approach and what we would, you know, want to approve, it's important that we have a backstop. And that backstop would be there in the event that either the commitments, the agencies don't actually follow up and move forward with restoration projects and flow, or putting together the science and governance committees, we would have the backstop to be able to step in and order the flows under the flow only approach. And so I think that's an important tool that we can consider as we look at some of these other actions that are outside our process, like the biological opinion. Because the focus in the end, it's called a red, yellow, green light. So the program, whatever we adopt, if we do adopt under healthy rivers and landscapes, there would be a process annual review, triennial reviews, and in year eight, at the end of the program, we would be evaluating the program to determine whether it needs a red light. You know, was it a failure? Do we need to do something else? Does it need a yellow light? Like, let's slow down and take a look at this and see if we need more assets on the table for the protection of the fish. Or green light, does it look good, you know, in the reports that we've been receiving? And so that process is in there, and embedded within that process, if we get to a red light, then we would have that backstop available for our board to then shift over to a flow-only approach. And so I think, you know, there's still plenty of opportunity to deliberate and improve on what's before us. But I think that generally speaking, as one board member, the framework is something that, you know, we really should look at, because it does provide for that backstop, you know, moving forward with this, you know, sort of novel approach. But it would be providing the backstop in the event that it doesn't work. Details to, you know, the devil's in the details, of course.
Well, thank you very much for that complete answer. It makes me happy that I'm here in the North Coast.
It's complicated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Board members, any questions, comments? Well, Dee Dee, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I did look it up. The next workshop is December 12th. That's that accounting, the flow accounting workshop. And then on January 23rd, we will have a workshop that's focused on some additional alternatives that staff has suggested that, you know, we not actually have included in what they've proposed yet, but potential alternatives as to actions that can be undertaken to protect those flows in the Healthy Rivers and Landscape Program, or under a regulatory approach with a backstop, how those flows could be protected so that once they're released, somebody else downstream wouldn't be able to pick them up. And so that workshop is on January 23rd. Thank you, and Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you all.
Thank you, and likewise. All right, time for public hearing.
If you'll entertain it, Mr. Chair, I'd love to give a few brief updates to the board before public forum. Okay, thank you. Good morning. I'm Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer. I just wanted to provide the board with an update on some staffing changes in the office, namely a few staff that have moved into new leadership roles in the office. So I think you all have interacted with Mona Doherty, who is a long-serving staff member at the North Coast Region and most recently was serving as the senior of our Northern Cannabis and Agriculture Unit. And Mona has now transitioned back to a program that she worked in the past. She'll be leading up our new NPDES wastewater unit. As board members may be aware, our office has combined the NPDES wastewater and stormwater programs into one unit of staff, even though they are two distinct programs. And it's been a long time goal to split those into two different units, each with its own senior supervisor, to be able to better meet the voluminous needs of those programs. So we're very excited to have accomplished that restructuring. So now Heaven Moore, who was serving as the senior for both programs, is now serving over the NPDES stormwater unit, and Mona has moved over to the NPDES wastewater unit as senior. So that's an exciting change. Another exciting change is that we have a brand new unit within our planning and watershed stewardship division called the Watershed Assessment and Recovery Unit. And the first task of that unit will be working on a new permit to implement roads aspects of the Wallala River TMDL, sediment TMDL. And so I'm pleased to share that Devin Rabellino, who you might remember from her excellent work on the federal lands permit, who has been working as an engineering geologist in our timber program, is moving over to serve as the senior of that new unit. And then finally, Tanya Wiper, who you may recall recently being honored with an award for her excellent work, you know, providing administrative support to thousands of enrollees in our cannabis program, has been promoted to Staff Services Manager 1 Specialist, still within the cannabis program, but she'll be taking on more of a leadership role, including improving administrative processes, training staff, conducting enforcement, coordinating with interagency partners. So really a growth of her role in that program. And that is that's a specialist position, non-supervisory, but all of our specialists are a really important part of our leadership team in the office. So really excited to have those folks in new leadership positions within the office. And then the other item that I wanted to highlight briefly now is for the board and the public and all of the wastewater permittees that I imagine are intently listening into our board meeting is to share that our staff in the wastewater programs, both NPDES and the discharge to land programs, have initiated a newsletter for wastewater permittees, and that's going out quarterly, and it's just another way for us to communicate with our permittees, provide information and resources, and just kind of keep their participation in water boards permits at top of mind. And so any wastewater permittees that want to sign up for that can do so right on the homepage of our website. We also have the archive newsletters available on our website, but I just wanted to highlight that excellent creative effort on the part of our staff to find another way to communicate with our permittees and stay in touch. So that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. Well, I applaud the staff for their efforts, for their promotions being promoted, and their creativity in reaching out to various parts of our region, which makes the communication, the relationship stronger. So here we go. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to item number 4, public hearing on proposed amendment order number R1-2024-0052.
Public forum.
Oh, I'm sorry. I jumped. Yes, let's do, strike that. We'll do public forum. Time will be reserved for the general public to address the board on any matter within the board's jurisdiction, excluding those items on the agenda. The board chair may limit the public forum to 30 minutes initially and continue any remaining appearances beyond the 30 minutes at the end of the regularly scheduled business day. The board chair may request that each person addressing the board limit their presentation to 5 minutes. Deidre?
Brenda?
Sorry, Brenda, I jumped the gun.
Good morning. Brenda Edelman from Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I think I can do this in 5 minutes, but my vocal cords are 85 years old now, and I may need to ask for a little extra time.
You take the time you need.
I'm sorry.
Take the time you need.
Thank you very much. And I do have copies of my talk also. According to a graph in the TMDL staff report on bacteria sources, from 2007 through mid-2017, Russian River County Sanitation District illegally discharged 5 times the amount of raw or partially treated sewage than all 18 other river discharges combined. There were also significant illegal releases in 2017 and 2019. Last year, a $1 million penalty, or a little over, was assigned to our CSD for a spill in 2019, and those funds are now being used by the county to study the possibility of joining numerous small systems in West County. It was the same county agency that manages the RRCSD that has been responsible for so many illegal discharges while complaining they never have enough money to adequately maintain the system. The pipelines and pumps, et cetera, deteriorate in 40 plus years and then cost outrageous amounts to repair and or replace. They never can collect enough money to properly maintain the system. RRCSD is currently looking at a need for $50 million or more to replace critical infrastructure, and grant funds are not available at this time. Penalty funds could not be used to fix the system and instead went to the county, which is the entity in charge of managing RRCSD, to plan the above-mentioned project. In the meantime, our community is paying, and we are a disadvantaged community income-wise, over $2,000 a year for sewer, and the last 2 years got hikes of over 9%. That's the second highest fee for sewage in county, that the county is in charge of the systems. And the operators never have enough left over to make meaningful repairs. These same staff people are earning as much as the top staff people make over $400,000 a year with benefits. And that comes out partly out of our pocket. The West County Wastewater Pipeline proposal is being sold to people with the idea that they will save money by combining facilities with others. Another sales pitch is that the water is needed for agricultural irrigation in the summer, and that will be a beneficial reuse. Well, the water for irrigation is most needed during drought, but when there is limited availability for drinking, there is also limited wastewater availability to feed plants. Santa Rosa ponds can go down as much as under 1.5 billion gallons to 200 million gallons in a season, although that's the most extreme. And their farmers can be totally cut off from supply when that occurs. Yet consultants recommended to the supervisors that a 10% design of hookup to RRCSD will be the next step. They made this the preferred next step simply on the basis that they determined septic solutions would not work out. And it may not be totally clear, but there was a study done by consultants on the possibility of hooking up Monterio and Villa Grande either to Russian River County Sanitation District or to some other plan that where it can go all the way to Santa Rosa. And that the other plan they looked at was upgrading and replacing septic systems, which they're on now. So just, I'll say this document they just completed in September, they spent 18 pages studying septic systems in the study area, and it was pretty well done. I have no complaints about that. Then they spent another 10 pages on central sewer systems, different varieties, and only 2 of the 10 pages cover the hookup to RRCSD and possible hookup to Santa Rosa. And they focus on collection system to get sewage from Monterio to Villa Grande to RRCSD. But what they don't talk about in these 2 pages out of 40, they don't talk about the fact that the part of this, our system that they want to hook up to this other community is the most failure-ridden part of our whole system. And it's the point in the system, the main pump station, where over 90% of all the raw sewage goes through that point in the system. It crosses the river and then goes down a road about a mile to the treatment plant. So that's one of the areas that has some of the most failures and is the most sensitive. And the county made a good faith effort to get funding to fix, do some of the critical repairs. And they got all the way to 90% design phase and then was told by the state that there is no money for them this year. So the Monterey Villa Grande Wastewater Solutions Project, after spending 18 pages on, which is almost half of the report pages, on discussing why it is not feasible to upgrade and replace individual or community septic systems. They spent these two pages discussing why hooking up to our CSD would be the preferred option. They did not discuss major problems with the system, pending costs, frequent spills during floods, and other negative conditions. They haven't considered flood impacts, capacity of the system, deterioration of the pipelines due to old age, prohibitive costs for repair, $50 million at least, and lack of available funding. And finally, the county, in January, I believe, is going to consider authorizing the consultant to move on to the next phase, which would be a 10% design. And the consultant recommended that the next phase, that the Russian River hook up to the Russian River County Sanitation District be the preferred project. So, you know, it's a disadvantaged community, lots of low-cost housing, but there's a mix of housing. And it's a very difficult problem because we can't get the – there's a lot of improvements that have been done to the treatment plant, but it's our collection system that is just deteriorating from age. And I know this is a statewide problem. It's not our problem alone. And just quickly, I'll add that one of the projects they're looking at that I don't think is viable myself is to run a pipeline from Monterey Villa Grande to Occidental, where they're going to be building a pipeline to Grayton, because that's another whole long story, taking about 30 years of illegal discharges problems. And then from Grayton, considering going to Sebastopol, and from Sebastopol to Santa Rosa. And I just think that's a can of worms that could end up, maybe not right in the beginning, but could end up being a real nightmare. But that's going to be in the future. So at any rate, if you want, I have some copies of what I just spoke about. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Brenda, thank you so much for voicing your concerns. Oftentimes, we don't, those things aren't front of mind to us, but thank you so much. Greg?
Brenda, you know, you've brought this to this board several times over the years. Nobody knows the situation better than you, so that's why I'm asking you this. But if you had a magic wand and money was not a consideration, what needs to happen, in your opinion?
I think it would be possible to eventually hook up Monterey and Villa Grande to Russian River County Sanitation District. I'm not saying they should never do it. What I believe, though, is that they need to get our sewer system, and it covers Guerneville mainly and the area around there, which is a little bit east of Monterio and Villa Grande. And I just think they need to get our system fixed. And it's expensive, and the community can't afford it, and the grant funds aren't available. And what do you do? I mean, we just had, I think, a small spill. Now there was all kinds of flooding on the river, even in houses and structures, and people lost their life savings, some of them. And yet the county didn't warn people because it was projected that it would be a flood, but it would be a very low flood and it wouldn't affect people.
That was this last storm last month?
A few weeks ago. So what I saw in writing was that that because of global warming and climate change, the patterns that sometimes it floods even when the ground is dry and absorbing a lot of the water, and sometimes the houses don't flood much when there's flooding in other places. I mean, it's getting erratic and unpredictable is a simple way of putting it. And there are a lot of people in all three communities have a lot of structures in the floodplain. And what to do about that is another big issue, because you can't kick people out of their properties. I once thought buying them out might ultimately be a cheaper solution than continually worrying about maintaining these systems in a floodplain.
It sounds like there have been a number of planning starts, but none of them have come to completion.
Well, there's never enough money to do it right, I guess.
Well, thank you again for bringing this to us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest. Do you want a copy?
Thank you, Brenda. Next on the agenda is item number 4, public hearing on proposed amendment order number R1-2024-0052 to consider the amendment of order number R1-2020-0012, waste discharge requirements for the City of Santa Rosa, Santa Rosa Water Reuse System, Laguna Treatment Plant, WDID number 1B830990SON, NPDES number CA0022764. This was scheduled as an uncontested item. If there are no comments from the city, public, board members, or staff, I will proceed directly to a vote.
We need a motion, right?
Yes, sir.
So, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt R1-2024-0052 as written.
I second.
Deidre, would you please call the vote?
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Vice Chair Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Hart?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have item number 5, public hearing on order number R1-2024-0055, rescinding waste discharge requirements and associated monitoring and reporting programs for Willits Environmental Remediation Trust, former ABEX Corporation, REMCO Hydraulics Facility Number Facility Order Number R1-2009-0001. This was scheduled as an action item, but unless there are comments from the permittee, public, board members, or staff, I will consider this item uncontested and proceed directly to a vote.
You need a motion, Mr. Chair?
May I make a comment?
Yes, please.
Having lived and worked through the hexavalent chromium disaster that this facility did to the city of Willits. I'm really pleased to see that we've gotten to a point where the agents that were used to clean that chemical up or that compound up are no longer needed. So this is a real milestone in what was, gosh, 20 years ago, a real significant problem. So it's just, I just wanted to, before we took the vote, I just wanted to express my gratitude to staff and sticking with it and cleaning up this mess.
Thank you, Vice Chair Giusti.
I'll make a motion that the board adopt order number R1-2024-0055. I so move.
Second.
Deirdre?
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Vice Chair Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Hart?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Thank you. That brings us to item number 6. This is the time and place for a hearing by the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider adoption of amendment order number R1-2024-0030, amending waste discharge requirements and master recycling permit for the Russian River County Sanitation District and Sonoma Water. Russian River Wastewater Treatment Facility. This item has been properly noticed. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand, raise your right hand, and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Thank you. Timelines for this presentation are as follows. Staff, 20 minutes. Permittee, 20 minutes. Interested public, 5 minutes each. Board questions, 15 minutes. At this time, we will start with a staff presentation.
Thank you. Maybe just dim them. I'll be fine. All right. Good morning, Chairman Bedoya and members of the board. My name is Matt Herman. I am an engineer in your NPDES unit and the current caseworker for the Russian River Wastewater Treatment Facility. This presentation will address item 6 of today's board meeting, the proposed amendment order for the Russian River Wastewater Treatment Facility's NPDES permit. We are proposing to reopen this permit today to require the Russian River County Sanitation District and Sonoma Water to submit an updated collection system operations and maintenance plan and to provide clarification on what is expected of the district and Sonoma Water for the required engineering evaluation report. This presentation will provide a brief background on the Russian River Wastewater Treatment Facility and the associated collection system, a discussion on the 2023 enforcement action that was undertaken, describe the proposed changes to the discharger's NPDES permit that are being recommended today, identify the public comments received on this item, and provide staff's recommendation to the board. The Russian River County Sanitation District is the owner of the wastewater treatment facility and serves the greater Guerneville area. In this area, the district's collection system consists of 34.1 miles of gravity sewers, 4.2 miles of force mains, and has approximately 2,497 service lateral connections. Sonoma Water is the contract operator for the Russian River County Sanitation District, and both the district and Sonoma Water are subject to the requirements of the regulatory orders associated with this facility, including the facility's NPDES permit and the statewide sanitary sewer general order. In December 2023, the Regional Water Board imposed an administrative civil liability of $1,033,546 onto Sonoma Water and the Russian River County Sanitation District in response to three alleged sanitary sewer overflow violations that occurred between February and March 2019. This ACL, settlement agreement and stipulation for entry of order number R1-2023-0049, allows for $886,545 of the liability to be suspended pending completion of the enhanced compliance action titled West County Water Quality and Recycled Water Supply Feasibility Project with Stakeholder Committee. 82 of the 83 public comment letters received during the 2023 enforcement action expressed a concern for the administrative liability not being spent on corrective actions to fix the district's collection system and asked the Regional Water Board to do more to prevent future sanitary sewer overflow events. While the state's enforcement policy does not allow for the Regional Water Board to apply the liability amount from discretionary enforcement action towards compliance projects, Regional Water Board staff committed to proposing an amendment to the facility's NPDES permit that would require the district and Sonoma Water to implement any identified corrective actions needed to prevent sanitary sewer overflows. In response to concerns expressed by the public and in accordance with federal regulations, the Regional Water Board is proposing to modify the district's NPDES permit. Specifically, after determining that the facility's collection system operations maintenance plan was out of date and not representative of all current practices, staff have added a requirement for the district to submit an updated collection systems operations maintenance plan. Additionally, the NPDES permit has been modified to clarify requirements of the engineering evaluation final report by requiring a schedule of implementation for all corrective actions identified within this report. This section has further been modified to require the district and Sonoma Water to submit the engineering evaluation final report to the Regional Water Board's executive officer for review and approval. The proposed amendment order was properly noticed to the public, and Regional Water Board staff received a single written comment letter from Sonoma Water. Sonoma Water identified that while they do not oppose many of the edits, that they believe the permit should be modified during the course of the permit's five-year reissuance because a legal basis for the midterm amendment may not be present. Sonoma Water therefore requested that the permit be updated through its regular five-year reissuance. Furthermore, Sonoma Water requested that if the Regional Water Board moves forward with the amendment order, that the collection system operations and maintenance plan due date be adjusted to coincide with the engineering evaluation's final report's due date to allow use of the information gained through the engineering evaluation to be incorporated within the collection system operations and maintenance plan. Regional Water Board staff have identified that the amendment order has been undertaken in response to new information identified after the NPDES permit's adoption. And as requested by Sonoma Water, staff have updated the due date for the collection system's operations and maintenance plan to August 1st, 2025, to coincide with the due date for the engineering evaluation final report. A complete summary of the comments received and the Regional Water Board's responses are provided in the response to comments document included within the board package. To conclude, it is staff's recommendation to the board to adopt amendment order number R1-2024-0030 as proposed. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Matt. Thanks for all your work on this. How would you characterize this amendment moving this facility towards a positive result to address the many issues it's had that Brenda just shared with us and the action this board took in that initial liability settlement? Does this move the needle in the right direction, I guess is what I'm asking?
It does. It is a small step. I think the amendment order is more to express our desire for action to be taken. Until we receive the engineering evaluation report that's required, we don't have those specific corrective actions to really enforce upon. So at this point, we're just asking them to provide that schedule of implementation, and we're ensuring we can approve or return that if we don't feel that it's enough action.
Board members, any comments, questions? Then I would entertain a motion to. Is there public comment, Brenda?
I believe yes. There is. Yeah.
Brenda?
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. We did not submit comments on this because at the time this consultant's report was demanding my full attention. But I did read through the amendment many times trying to figure out if there was any problem or something missing. And I think it's well done. At least I can't predict anything negative coming out of it, but the devil's in the details, and it remains to be seen what the water agency does with it and how they respond and what their reports look like. I am hopeful that it will be able to move us forward in trying to resolve these issues. And we'll just have to see. But I thank your staff for the work they've done on this, and I'm hopeful that we can make some progress. But I think the biggest issue is a need for money. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And given the current administration, I'm not sure if we're going to have that available to us or not. It's a scary time from my perspective. So thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you, Brenda. Deidre, is there anybody on Zoom?
No.
I'll move to adopt amendment order number R1-2024-0030 as proposed.
I so second.
Deidre, would you call the vote, please?
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Vice Chair Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Hart?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Thank you. So that moves us to information items. Item number 7.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I anticipate item 7 being lengthier than the items that have happened so far, and so I would suggest possibly taking a quick break because this is the kind of our longest item of the morning. It might be nice to have the chance for a break before it.
Executive Officer Quinto, your recommendation is fully accepted. Thank you. And appreciated. Oh, let's take 15 minutes, come back at 25 after. All right. Item number 7. It's an informational item, and we have Kason Grady to present the staff's cannabis enforcement strategy. Take it away, Kason.
Good morning, Chair Bedoya, members of the board. Kason Grady, Supervising Water Resource Control Engineer of your staff, and I oversee the Agriculture and Enforcement Division. If you bear with me one second, I believe my mic's on, yeah. I had a little IT issue, one second. Okay, so I am, just for the record, I might speak a little slower than I might normally. We are being interpreted live, so I'll try to speak slowly to give them some time to interpret my words. All right, I am here today to review the progressive enforcement process for the cannabis cultivation program, various challenges with that process to address water quality impacts from this industry, and staff's proposed strategy to be more efficient and effective protecting water quality. Next slide, please. Oh, I think I have this. Let me just make sure. Okay, great. All right, so here's an outline of my presentation, and I'll first review why we need a cannabis program-specific enforcement strategy. Then I'll discuss various challenges that we face that are unique to this program. And then I'll offer some updated strategies to address those challenges, along with a proposal to assess the effectiveness of this new approach and report back to the board on our progress. At the close of my presentation, I look forward to a discussion with the board and the public to get feedback on the proposed strategy. Okay, so why do we need a cannabis program-specific enforcement strategy? First and foremost, because these threats to water quality are commonly found at cannabis cultivation sites. And if you bear with me, I'm going to start a little bit from the beginning. I know some board members may be more familiar with Water Board's regulation of cannabis than others, so I'm going to do some foundational review. So these threats to water quality we commonly find: sediment discharges, removal of riparian habitat, dredge and fill in wetlands and streams, stream impoundment and rerouting, undersized and misaligned culverts, poorly designed and maintained roads, solid waste, human waste, fertilizers, pesticides, petroleum products, and other chemicals. Okay, I will now provide some photographs showing examples of those water quality threats. I will begin with some site conditions that could be resolved with relatively simple actions that don't necessarily require additional permitting or planning or professional assessment, meaning they could be easily and quickly resolved. So sediment, these two pictures depict some sediment discharges. Apologize for the, it's not quite that clear on the PowerPoint, but sediment discharges are one of the primary threats of pollution that we experience on these sites. Sometimes they can be fixed with simple actions. Here we have concentrated sediment-laden stormwater in a roadside ditch that flows directly into a stream. I'm good. Thank you. On the left-hand photo here, we have a road that is approaching a stream without water bars, rolling dips, or outsloping, which could hydrologically disconnect the road from the stream and minimize the types of sediment discharges that I just showed. The right-hand image shows erosion and sediment transport from a site, which could be prevented or fixed using erosion and sediment control best management practices, or BMPs. Here, the left photo shows solid waste that we often find at cultivation sites. And I'll note that it's uncontained, strewn about the property, threatening to discharge to nearby streams when it rains. The right-hand photo shows potting soils discharged down a hillside and also threatening to transport to nearby streams and potentially discharge to groundwater when it rains. The simple remedial actions here would be collect, contain, and properly dispose of your solid waste and cultivation-related wastes. Could be as simple as gathering it up, taking it to an appropriately licensed facility like a landfill, and providing receipts that you've done that.
Kason, just a quick question. Are these relatively recent photos or historic photos of problems you've seen? Or are you still seeing these kinds of problems?
Yeah, I can't speak to the date of each of these photos, but what I can confidently attest to is that we still see these examples in the field all the time.
Well, that's disappointing.
It really is.
Like Kasen, how often do you see it buried?
I would say occasionally. Sometimes we encounter buried solid waste, burned. We see remnants of burn piles, which, you know, then who knows what was in that, right? And so that could require some assessment to determine the necessary cleanup actions. So there's a wide range of problems that we see. And just to bring back to these, I point these out because these actions to clean up would actually be very simple. You don't need to hire a professional to gather up your waste and take it to a landfill. But without doing it, it does pose a threat to water quality because all of these things could discharge to a stream. Both of these photos show human waste discharges through black pipes to the ground surface. Oh, I have to stay in. Oh, there's a delay. Human waste through black pipes discharging to the ground surface and threatening surface waters and groundwaters. And yes, to go back to the prior comment, very recently we observed a site like this that we plan to act on. Here, this photo shows various chemicals without secondary containment that need to be properly disposed of off-site, including fertilizers and pesticides. Sometimes we find other water quality threats that involve more complex remedial actions and usually require professional planning, design, and permitting. These include wetland dredge and fill and on-stream ponds requiring removal, restoration, or upgrades. Often these can be unstable features and can pose hazardous conditions. We also find discharges of petroleum and other chemicals that require more thorough investigation, assessment, and cleanup with professional oversight. Here are some examples of unpermitted grading and soil disturbance that may be beyond the scope of implementing simple erosion and sediment control management practices. And here, the left photo shows a culvert that is misaligned with the stream channel with vertical displacement at the outlet, which would require a permit from us to fix. And the right-hand photo shows a slope failure along a road prism. Both of these fixes should involve professional oversight. So this is the end of the pictures that I'll show you, summarizing all of those threats to water quality, establishing the foundation for why we are out there on these sites and the issues that we find. So now I'll get to why we need a cannabis program-specific enforcement strategy. The North Coast remains a primary producer in the United States and in California of both legal and illegal cannabis. For the past few years, our agency, our staff here, have had 5 field staff, 2 of which have been purely dedicated to enforcement. Then in 2023, to address water quality impacts from illegal cultivation, the governor and legislature recently increased our resources from 5 total field staff to 8, with a funding reallocation that shifts our staff focus from 2 dedicated enforcement field staff to 7. This represents a 60% increase in our field staff and a doubling of the percent of our field staff dedicated to enforcement. relative to our other water boards programs, 7 dedicated field staff may seem like a lot, but the scope and scale of cannabis cultivation in the North Coast is unique relative to all other land use activities that we regulate, and cannabis is the only regulated commodity that has a substantial illegal market, which brings with it very unique enforcement challenges. Yes?
Sorry. Okay. Where are most of the staff based? Are they based down here in Santa Rosa, or are they kind of spread throughout?
They're spread somewhat equally currently between the Eureka office and here.
Okay. Thank you.
That was my question as well. Thank
you. Okay. So to summarize my answer to this question is that there is a unique industry that is widespread throughout our region with few staff to address the variety of impacts that I have summarized. So this is why we need a strategy for this program, but why do we need to make changes to our existing enforcement approach, not just this program? Well, we want to increase the number of enforcement actions that we take and our overall compliance rate. Since 2016, we have only issued 32 cleanup and abatement orders in this program, even though we have issued over 1,400 notices of violation, most of which have required some form of remedial action. The reasons for this are both resource and process related. Our enforcement process takes hundreds of days to initiate and often years to complete. Ultimately, we only have a 16% compliance rate for our cleanup and abatement orders, meaning those that have fully cleaned up their sites and we have closed the cases. This must be improved, and having just received some additional staff, we cannot expect to get any more staff. So to do more enforcement while simultaneously being more effective, we must adjust our enforcement process to achieve this goal. So I summarize the reason that we need to change our approach as this. Given our limited number of staff, the number of sites to address, we need to be more efficient and expedited process to be more effective. To do this, we need to immediately issue penalties for discharge violations when possible, and issue cleanup and abatement orders more quickly, and commit ourselves to enforcing their requirements immediately when they are violated. All right, having established the need for process change, I will now review the challenges that we face. Our primary challenges are resource and process related. The volume or sheer number of cultivation sites in our region is primarily a resource-related challenge, and our existing enforcement process is both a resource and a process challenge. Since permitted sites are already attempting to comply with the regulations by getting permits, paying fees, hiring consultants, and implementing management practices, our primary enforcement focus is on illegal sites. To get a sense of how many illegal sites are in the state, the Water Boards has developed a model to automatically identify cannabis cultivation-related infrastructure using satellite imagery, which we coined Cannavision. Initial data from this model corroborates our understanding from on the ground in partnership with other agencies that there are thousands of illegal cultivation sites in our region alone. With only
earthquake. Drop, cover, hold on, shaking expected. Earthquake.
Here? That's what my phone says. Never had that happen before.
I have, yeah. Where's my alert?
Oh, okay.
There it is.
I have a plastic table to cover me here, so.
All right, let's continue.
Okay.
Yes.
Hey, Kaysen.
Yes.
I know when I was on the Board of Supervisors in Humboldt, they we bought a pretty sophisticated satellite viewing system that let it go like super close to the ground, and we could see from year to year what changes happened. Is this close to the same system, or do we share data with the counties that have these kinds of systems in place already? How does that work? Oh, there it goes.
Shall we take a break?
Yeah.
Okay, we experienced, for the public out there, we experienced an earthquake, and we all got alerts on our phones, and that was the reason for this break, this interesting experience.
It was a six?
So we'll continue with your presentation. Well, we either do two things. Either we take a break, pause for about 10 minutes, or we resume.
I think it's up to you, Chair. I think safety-wise, we're fine now.
Okay. In the interest of time and respecting your schedules, I say we continue.
Okay. So I don't entirely remember where I was. So I'll just start where I think I was.
I've got a question.
Okay.
Do you see the activity, is the activity on the increase or is it on the decline?
I have not done analysis, over time to quantify that or show it. I think that there's greater market conditions at play that are causing, the price of cannabis to drop, which is causing, a decline. With that said, though, there's still apparently a sufficient financial incentive for illegal cultivation, for export to other states and other places that we still continue to see it. And I'll show you on a slide, I think maybe my next slide or soon, some data from 2022, which... at a region-wide scale is the most recent data we have. We have even more recent data, but it's on a more kind of site-specific basis. So I'll get to that in a second.
And despite a potential decline, there's still hundreds of legacy sites with...
Well, and not just legacy, I would say active sites.
Okay.
Yeah. So with only 7 inspectors for a region that covers... 12.4 million acres, or 12% of the state of California, and thousands of illegal cultivation sites, there are hundreds of illegal sites per inspector, in addition to the 2,400 enrolled sites, or another 340 sites per inspector. With these kinds of numbers, it's imperative to be efficient and to use enforcement to create a deterrent effect that discourages all growers from breaking the law. So here's the slide that I was describing to you. And here are some visuals of our region and the territory that we cover in blue. I don't think the tsunami warning will affect us. But at least our emergency systems are working, I guess.
Oh my God, I just hurt all of my devices.
You're lighting up like a Christmas
tree. I'm too connected.
You're...
All right, so these two figures show our region, and the left-hand figure shows the distribution of our 2,400 enrollees, and the right-hand figure shows the distribution of potential unenrolled cannabis cultivation sites as identified in our latest CannaVision broad-scale data set from 2022. From this, you can see the scale and wide distribution of cultivation sites in our region with cumulative threats and impacts to water quality, including sediment, temperature, nutrients, human and solid wastes in sensitive and impaired watersheds.
Kason, yeah, trying to stay focused here with all the distractions. So on the right, the blue dots, potential non-regulated cannabis operations, but do those dots actually represent an actual grow site?
So
most of them anyway.
What I have to describe the model and what it represents, and it can be a little bit of a rabbit hole, but if you bear with me, each dot represents, in order to visualize it at this scale, you have to aggregate the data to a larger scale. So each square represents 9 square kilometers. And on the right-hand side, within each square, I put a minimum cutoff of at least 1,000 square meters of associated potential infrastructure. To point out that each one has at least 1/4 acre of some identified feature. Now, these are automated outputs from the model. They have not been gone through the QAQC process that staff would go through to answer your question with confidence on a site-specific basis.
I'm just looking at the concentration down at the southern tip, and I'm just wondering, you know, are those just backyard grows, or are they, you know, 6 plants, or is there a greenhouse or some other structure that the algorithm that you put in, the formula, it captured those in the model?
Yeah, that's a really good observation, and one that, you know, it's difficult to tease out when you deal with a map at this scale. But okay. I think your instinct is correct, because the data represents 3 feature classes. Outdoor cultivation, which is a pattern recognition of based on the way outdoor cultivation is grown. It also, the other 2 feature classes are greenhouses, so like closed, covered greenhouses that are white and highly reflective, and then there's open greenhouses that are where you can see green within the greenhouse, but you also see the structure and the ridges of the greenhouse. So my hypothesis would be along the lines of yours, that in Sonoma County area, it's not necessarily cannabis cultivation, that it's probably combined with other forms of agriculture. And so I don't come to the conclusion that all of it is cannabis. But what I can say to you is this, that our current research is showing that when we take the data as shown on the right-hand side and we send it through our QAQC process with staff reviewing it, we get upwards of 90% accuracy, where relative to on-the-ground field inspections with CDFW, we've confirmed that those sites match up with the model outputs. So this doesn't have the 90% plus accuracy, but it's a step before that that gets us to coming up with quality data. So what this helps us identify is that there are many, many areas in our region, and on the right-hand side, which are outside of the areas where we have permits, that are worth investigating and looking into. And I think the other thing that's important to point out, and you can't quite see it on the scale here due to the resolution, but it goes from 1/4 acre up to hundreds of thousands of square meters of density in each square. So when you start to get those larger numbers of hundreds of thousands of square meters of cultivation you don't need to go through the QAQC process to have a very high degree of confidence that when we do go through that process, we will find cannabis in those areas. So it's a screening tool that we use to help us get a sense of the breadth and scope and scale of where it may exist in our region.
So by definition, an illegal grow simply could be someone that has not enrolled in the program. That would be considered an illegal program.
It would be, although legality is ultimately determined whether or not somebody has a license from the Department of Cannabis Control.
Okay.
And our enrollment is one of the prerequisites for that license.
I didn't realize that you needed an actual license to grow. So, okay.
Yeah. There's a state agency. Originally, it was tasked with CDFA, and then it turned into the Department of Cannabis Control. And they give a license based on a local permit from the county, lake and stream bed alteration agreement from Fish and Wildlife, and an enrollment with us, as well as an application to them for the license and all of the review that they do.
Thank you for that.
Let me see here. All right, so the other biggest challenge that we face has been our own resource-intensive enforcement process. There are many steps to the process and a need to provide ongoing compliance assistance. After an inspection, our existing processes take approximately 130 days to issue a cleanup and abatement order, and upwards of 500 days or more to issue an administrative civil liability complaint alleging fines. In this program, we have been offering similarly high levels of compliance assistance, both to permitted and illegal sites, which has caused us to spend staff time trying to assist illegal cultivators that could be redirected to advancing enforcement on those sites or redirected to address other violations. Collectively, it takes 5 to 10 staff members from the inspector to management, legal, and executives to process each formal enforcement case. So it's quite resource intensive. Here is a quick visual of our current enforcement process and the many steps involved. Note that this is the same process for enrolled and illegal sites. I'm not going to talk about every step here, but I will briefly summarize this process, which progresses from inspections on the left to monetary penalty assessment in orange and the property lien on the far right at the end. At any point in this process where a responsible party complies and addresses the violations, we can close the case and redirect our resources as shown with the green box on the bottom. Our existing process results in not issuing complaints until many days, months, or even years have passed, resulting in large proposed penalty amounts. I will note that the strategies that I'm going to discuss here in the subsequent slides attempt to speed up this process by shortening the associated time frames between steps and also bypassing some steps when appropriate. This should result in more complaints coming to the board for consideration for smaller penalty amounts. But before I discuss our proposed strategies, there are a few other enforcement challenges that are unique to this industry. First, we face multiple challenges at the inspection phase. Our staff have limited access to sites because without the ability to gain consent, we must rely on law enforcement to obtain criminal search warrants. And due to the illegal nature of the activity, our staff rely on law enforcement to provide security to make our inspections safe. Since law enforcement is the lead on these search warrants, our staff is limited in the amount of time we have available to inspect, and oftentimes we can only collect a subset of information, and we at times must issue investigative orders to gather additional information. And third, our staff do not have the authority to issue monetary citations in the field, and must utilize our agency authorities to first issue orders to establish enforceable requirements, or if there's a direct discharge to a blue line stream, then staff can proceed directly to issuance of a complaint, which would then be heard by the regional board to assess a penalty. After the inspection phase, we must demonstrate service of our enforcement documents to responsible parties, and then staff often encounter transient and non-responsive dischargers, which can cause delays in compliance. Another challenge is that the first time the board hears the details of a given case is often when your staff has progressed all the way to issuance of a complaint for failure to comply, and we've already invested many resources in the process. Finally, from our experience, enrollment enforcement has limited utility. This is due to a variety of factors. Eradication occurs during warrant inspections, eliminating cultivation. So if the grower ceases to cultivate, there would be no pathway for them to obtain a local permit or a state license. Also, this has the potential to introduce conflicts with other agencies. If we enroll a site that has no way of obtaining a local permit, then we would be enrolling a site with an unpermittable land use. Excuse me, I just scroll back in my slides. Where did I go? Okay. Okay, so So in relation to those complications with enrollment enforcement and the eradication and enrolling sites that may not be able to get a local permit, our agency partners have expressed concerns that this could create a gray market where some cultivators would have some but not all of the necessary enrollments with the various regulating agencies. If these concerns are not effectively addressed, this approach could damage our interagency partnerships that we rely on to do our jobs. If this were to impact our invitations to participate in criminal search warrants, then it would undermine our ability to protect water quality on these sites. Finally, enrollment enforcement, like all enforcement, is resource intensive, but it does not come with requirements to clean up and restore the site. So sites could fail to enroll and be subject to monetary penalties, and we would still have to follow up with a cleanup and abatement order to get the site cleaned up. So I think that effectively summarizes various challenges that we face with enforcement in this program. And so in light of these challenges, I'll go to the next slide. How do we increase our rate of compliance and enforcement output without increasing our staff? And our proposal is to refocus how we allocate our staff resources. And this brings us to our first proposed enforcement strategy, and I would say our primary proposed strategy, which is to expedite enforcement for illegal cultivation sites. To do this, we propose to more rapidly issue cleanup and abatement orders when there are simple remedial actions. We recently developed a template for this, which is being used by our colleagues statewide for cleanups that don't require additional investigation or permitting. These activities include, and I'll refer you back to those pictures I gave, removal and disposal of solid waste at a landfill, disconnection of human waste pipes, removal of cultivation-related infrastructure, site stabilization and installation of erosion and sediment control management practices, and repair of upland roads. Issuance of these cleanup and abatement orders will improve our ability to ensure sites, all sites are cleaned up, and it'll improve our ability to address the cumulative impacts of this industry across the landscape and throughout our watersheds. We expect to be able to issue these actions within approximately 40 days, which is a reduction in processing time of about 3 months for this step alone. We also propose to offer less compliance assistance to illegal sites relative to enrolled sites. We will still assist people to comply, but in providing less compliance assistance, we propose to move more quickly to issuance of complaints for discharges, and also for failure to comply with deadlines in existing enforcement orders, like cleanup and abatement orders. This will result in less staff resources per case and a faster progression through the enforcement process. This will likely result in more enforcement cases coming to the board for monetary penalty assessment, and will likely result in smaller penalties as we move more quickly through the process. Our second proposed enforcement strategy is to issue time schedule orders in certain circumstances. And I want to just acknowledge that I would describe this strategy as the exception, not the rule. But before we get into this strategy, I first want to discuss what these orders are, so you can understand how we're going to use them and why we're proposing to use them. So these orders can only be issued after violation of an existing order. So by issuing a new time schedule, these orders effectively give more time to comply. And this may seem counterintuitive because this would extend compliance timeframes, which is counter to our goals of efficiency and expeditiousness. But these orders are designed to compel a discharger to take corrective action by setting a predetermined penalty for future noncompliance at an amount equivalent to the cost of compliance. So although these orders give more time, they also prioritize getting the cleanups done, and they send the message to the dischargers that they must spend the money either to clean up their site or to pay the water boards in the form of a penalty. Seems like in that scenario, you would just want to spend the money to clean up your site. Since cleanup and abatement orders already have compliance time schedules built in, it is important to enforce on those deadlines directly in most instances so that dischargers take those deadlines seriously. Still, using these time schedule orders can be helpful when time extensions are appropriate or when proceeding directly to a complaint is undesirable. One use case is to restart the clock on old backlogged cases where deadlines have long passed and potential penalties, I would argue, at times can be unreasonably large. Another use case is when someone has mostly complied with the requirements in a cleanup and abatement order, but where additional financial pressure could incentivize them to complete the job. Okay, so those are the two primary strategies, with the first one being, I would say, the rule, and the second one being the exception to the rule. And in addition to those two, we have these two supporting strategies. And these include terminating enrollments for cause in order to promote compliance with the Cannabis Cultivation General Order for our enrollees. Examples include when an enrollee gains a market advantage at the expense of the environment by causing significant egregious discharges or by failing to pay fees. In 2023, the State Water Board already started to terminate enrollments for failure to pay multiple years of unpaid invoices. This has already been an effective strategy statewide to increase the rate of fee collection and to send the message that if you want to maintain your license, you must pay your fees. The next supporting strategy, and I'll just note our last strategy, is to conduct enrollment enforcement when appropriate. This is effectively when someone continues to cultivate after being notified of the need to enroll. In these situations, we do propose to issue complaints, but due to the various challenges discussed previously, we do not anticipate this having broad-scale utility, more of a case-specific utility. All right, so these enforcement process changes will empower us to resolve our backlogged enforcement cases, increase the number of enforcement actions, especially cleanup and abatement orders and administrative civil liability complaints. This will empower us to require cleanup and restoration of more sites and address cumulative impacts from this industry, and to deter illegal cultivation and unpermitted site development, and finally, to increase compliance on enrolled sites. So assessing progress and success of any new strategy is important for, I would say, all projects. For this strategy, staff proposes to start in January 1st of 2025 and implement the strategy for a minimum of 2 years and report to the board on its status during that period through executive officer reports and in 2027 with an informational item before the board, or more frequently as the board sees fit. The key metrics that we plan to measure our success include an increase in formal enforcement actions, a decrease in the average time to issue enforcement actions, an increase in the number of dischargers actively complying with our orders, an increase in final actions achieved, and I describe those as the number of formal enforcement actions closed. So once somebody finally cleans up their site and we close the case, that's I would consider that a final action. Also, the number of sites cleaned up and restored, the total amounts of penalties both assessed and paid, and finally, the number of property liens recorded. So with that concludes my presentation today. I thank you very much for your time, and I'm ready for any questions or comments that the board or public may have. And I also just want to appreciate Director of the Office of Enforcement and our legal counsel for making their way from Sacramento to join us today. So if you have any questions relevant for them, they're here to answer them as well.
Kason, thank you for your presentation. Very detailed and thoughtful, and I hope this this program benefits our region. Board members, any questions?
I'll start. Great job, Kason. I guess what I found most disappointing in your presentation is I would have thought, and I'll show my naivete, I guess I would hope that with legalization of cannabis that the industry would have matured and improve some of its practices. But obviously, there's still a significant number of individuals involved that feel free to work in the outlaw mentality. And even going through our, you know, the EO's report and looking at the number of cannabis enforcement actions, I'm just sorry to see that there are still some major issues out there. That being said, you and your people are the ones in the trenches. If you're comfortable with this, I'm comfortable with this. If you think this will work to make your jobs more efficient, go for it. But I'll just repeat what I said during the briefing. You know, you just have to be honest with yourself. Obviously, you've put a lot of time and thought into what you've shared with us today, and just be honest. And as you're evaluating milestones in the next 2 years, you know, might have to recognize, well, this isn't working the way we thought. We have to tweak it in some way. But I'm looking forward to hearing, you know, the results over time. And I wish you well, because, again, I know you put a lot of time and thought into this. And if you think it's going to work, go for it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Giusti. If I could respond just to say, well, first, thank you for your support. That is one of our, I think, ultimate goals here, is to get the board support. And I definitely want to be clear that you'll be seeing this in action before we report back to you in the sort of progress report scenario. And I say that because it's ultimately the board that has authority to issue the final enforcement actions, right? So some of them are delegated to the executive officer, issuance of cleanup and abatement orders. But when we get to enforcing on those existing orders, as we have already done with a few cases that came in the last couple of years to you, those are going to have to come to this board, and we're going to have more hearings. You know, we're already looking in the spring to have some of those time schedule orders come to you to help first address our backlog. And then I would anticipate some ACL cases coming to the board for failure to comply with cleanup and abatement orders. And likely quite a few of those. And at times, they could be for very simple things. They may not be for the complex, you know, ugly looking sites, because, you know, the first things first is we need people to engage with us and do the simple remedial actions before they can even get to the more complex ones, right? If you're not willing to clean up your trash on your site or disconnect your human waste pipe, then what makes us think they're going to hire a consultant and develop a large scale restoration plan? So I just wanted to respond and appreciate your support and acknowledge that we'll be at a board meeting near you.
Thank you, Kason. It's interesting if you wonder about the dynamics with the new administration and their attempt to clear the environment of criminal organizations, what that effect might have on the cannabis illegal grow groups. There's up in the northern areas, there are criminal organizations that of all walks of life that carry out these grows, and I'm hopeful that there might be some good out of this next 4 years.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm also interested to see what comes. Thank you.
Just a couple quick comments. Thanks for your presentation. Loved it. I'm thrilled to hear that we have a beefed up staff for this division. And I understand that we have an office in Eureka and here, and kind of having staff centralized out of those offices. And I just encourage not to lose sight of some of our other far-flung areas, particularly when it comes to talking about the restoration of the Klamath River system and the challenges of addressing the types of grows that are in those upstream areas. And we can talk all day long about minimum flows. No amount of flow is going to compensate for flash weather events that it's going to take all those chemicals that may or may not be out there, and they're in these upstream areas going directly down into the basin, into the Klamath. So just not losing sight of that. How do you address it? I know it's really complex, and go after low-hanging fruit. That's a more efficient use of resources. I can understand that, but also just, you know, message to Sacramento, and just keep, I know I'm a kind of broken record on this point, but don't lose sight of that and keep trying to manage that system up there, because I think we will have a real issue on our hands if we don't pay attention to it with the chemical issues. I wish those photos you showed were something that would surprise me, but I've seen that so many times. I wish I hadn't. Anyway, so thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I'm curious with the illegals in terms of identification of the responsible parties, the illegal dischargers. Is this a major problem, or, and I understand also that you're dealing with abandoned sites as well. And so are there any mechanisms that you have for making sure that you can identify individuals?
I could answer that, but I look behind me because I think I have some greater experts than myself who could answer that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Yvonne West, Director of the Office of Enforcement of the State Water Board. Thank you, Kason, for a great presentation. The Canis program is definitely challenged with the identification of responsible parties. At the water boards, a lot of our authorities are keyed into the property owner. I do want to acknowledge that we do get trespass grows. A lot of these folks have lease agreements or some sort of agreement with property owners who are legally responsible with the conditions of their property. So we do end up naming or pursuing property owners of record frequently on our enforcement matters. We do have issues with properties changing hands fast, quickly. Recalcitrant property owners who are hard to nail down. We use the lien mechanism a lot more in the cannabis program because of this, because we have folks who don't pay their penalties once they're imposed. We end up liening the real property, and we'd have to collect when the property is sold. We also spend a lot of time, again, trying to identify responsible parties on site who can come forward and clean up the sites. It is a problem, and we work hard to address it. We just recently were able to get additional legislation on service of process, which is always an issue when we're trying to find these folks and make sure that they attend hearings. So we were able to get some additional tools for service of process. But that's one reason why the expedited cleanup and abatement order is really, really crucial to a broader success of the program, is because we need to get folks quickly and get them in here quickly and understand whether or not they're going to comply or they're going to evade us and sell the property, basically. So that's where it comes into this timing issue as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one of my follow-up questions was going to be legislative fixes. I believe we heard that our staff does not have the ability to issue financial penalties in the field. And so how active are we in terms of presumably working with legislative staff at the state board? And now we have a new assembly member for our region. Chris Rogers was sworn in at the beginning of the week. And I would be interested, you know, are you thinking that we might take an aggressive approach and see if we can't get some additional field authorities to help us?
Yeah, that's a great conversation to have, and it's one we've had since the start of the program. There are some nuances and complexities. Our authority to regulate cultivation sites, whether they're legal or regulated, is the same authority we use for all industries, in the sense that it's the Port of Cologne or the Clean Water Act. And we have contemplated and been able to get a few things that are cannabis-specific as far as enforcement tools. The reason we can't impose penalties immediately for these types of violations, one, they're unregulated, so they're not permit violations, of course, because they're not enrolled in our program. And two, it's just the underlying language of those statutes require us to come forward and and adopt like a cleanup and abatement order first, putting them on notice of the requirements and the violations and an opportunity to correct. We do have other state agencies involved in cannabis who have some more immediate citation authority for running an illegal cultivation site. And those are, we're working with those partners to have them use their tools. This is really an all hands on deck problem. And in the cannabis program, more than any other program at the water boards, is coordinated across a number of those state agencies who all come to the table to address these sites, to inspect these sites. It may be difficult. So I guess my point of that is it may be difficult to get an authority that may be duplicative of something that another agency has. But we definitely are having those conversations.
Okay. And if I, this kind of follows on to my next question, and that is, you didn't talk about permissive counties. Now, does permissive counties mean that there we get less cooperation in certain counties from law enforcement entities? And in the other direction, I used to have a connection with the alcohol and firearms people who are federal employees who were involved in raids on illegal cannabis operations and hauling out quantities by helicopter and various cowboy-related activities. So I'm curious about our relationships, both with quote-unquote permissive counties, and secondly, is there any federal presence anymore in cannabis enforcement?
Let me speak to that. Or you wanna... Okay. Yeah, on the federal presence issue, they are still active, but mostly in relation to federal and state lands. Those same programs still exist. When we get into private properties, we rely more heavily on our state law enforcement officers because we have legalized cultivation and provided a regulatory system for it. The federal agencies don't generally get involved in those types of inspections, but they are still very active. In other areas, like I said, in federal lands and state lands raids, which are always illegal. And then we also have the Unified Cannabis Enforcement Task Force, which we work with, which we are a part of on the state level, that works with a lot of licensing, taxing, and other agencies that it was specifically formed, what was it, 2 years ago, probably the governor's office, to really try to address the illegal market, not only on the cultivation side, but the distribution side. And we play a very important role in both that task force and just generally in our regulatory lives, because cannabis in California is a misdemeanor unless it's associated with some sort of other violation. And some of those violations are water code violations. So our water code violations will also actually elevate the cultivation crime to a felony. And so Kaysen and his staff, and I'll defer to Kaysen to add on to my answer, will get called upon to support criminal actions and testify to the water code violations in support of those actions in pursuing cultivators, as opposed to, like, a lot of our cleanup actions are directed more towards the landowners, who are sometimes the cultivators and sometimes they are leasing to cultivators. So,
yeah, and I would agree with that and say that we have really good, strong partnerships and relationships with law enforcement. And one strategy that I did not emphasize here, but it's true, we have a variety of additional strategies, and that one includes leveraging our relationships and supporting law enforcement in their actions and their cases. So as Yvonne mentioned, we do get subpoenaed, our staff do go testify in court on their criminal cases, and we recently attended a training put on by the California Hazardous Materials Inspectors Association, where a bunch of law enforcement personnel got together and water boards presented on our authorities to help educate and also learn from them and have open dialogue about how we can be supportive.
And then I understand there are illegal importations off pesticides that are part of the problem that you pointed out in your presentation, and the improper disposal of pest site containers, et cetera. So I'd just like to thank you for bringing us up to speed. It's very encouraging to hear that, in fact, here's a case where we are getting we have gotten additional enforcement resources, and particularly interested in the progress reporting over this next two-year period. So, Mr. Chair, congratulations on the report here, and I will continue to be very interested.
Thank you, Jake.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but 70% of the land surface or the land in the North Coast region is federal.
I can't speak to the exact number, but
and judging by the
probably,
maps that you presented.
I thought it was 47%.
I think it's 46.
Yep.
There's a very large percentage is federal.
Half of the land.
Yeah.
Huge acreage.
Well, thank you for the correction, 47. 46. Regardless, judging by the map, a lot of the illegal grows are on the federal lands. And do you get support by federal agencies at that magnitude?
So we would have to do additional analysis, you know, to compare the layers to determine which sites are on federal lands. But that does occur. We are usually less involved because, as my understanding, you know, there's no responsible party to hold accountable on those sites. And so there is law enforcement support that goes out and, you know, eradicates and does cleanups, and they do seek out those responsible parties when possible. But I think there's limitations on our ability to participate in that process.
Yeah, we don't have as strong of a role. There are a lot of federal resources that are focused on federal lands, and they do assist on state lands as well. They do have more enforcement options. They can pursue federal criminal violations against them because they're on federal trespass lands, and we don't get involved in them because they're not reliant on our Water Code Authority to get those prosecutions. They are more like go in and they grab folks while they're there. There's a more of a risk in that sense if you are caught. Cultivating on federal lands, the consequences are much more significant than a misdemeanor under California law in that sense. And there's really, you know, we get involved when we get consulted on the water quality impacts, maybe from a past grower, things like that, how to remediate. It's just not an area where it's heavily involved. We did in the beginning, anecdotally, I don't have the data. I think we saw folks move from trespass grows onto private lands in some ways because it's easier to hide within on a private land within legal cultivations and the legal penalties for those types of grows are less onerous than if you get captured on a federal land grow. But it's a different game in a lot of ways. Their federal resources are still there. We don't engage with them very much, and I don't know how to quantify them, whether they've changed over the course of this, whether there's more or less activity. But that's something we could probably get back to you on.
I have to say that this is a tremendous education for me, mm-hmm. and I imagine for our board members as well, is how these things work or don't.
Yeah, I would just add that I think our lack of involvement in some of those cases is, I think, more of a reflection of the different agencies utilizing our respective resources as efficiently as possible. It doesn't make sense for us to spend our resources there when we know it's handled. If they contact us and there's a nexus, as Yvonne mentioned, then we can engage on a case-specific basis. But generally speaking, feds have that covered, and then we focus our resources where they don't have jurisdiction. Or they do, but where they're not investing their resources.
Thank you.
Kind of real quick, hitting on your presentation last night, I think that just drive home the point that developing some of these relationships with some historically underserved groups, or I think it's no secret there's a you know, a lot of these grows, whether illegal or legal, they tend to involve minority communities and those communities that can be afraid, that want to be willing to work, but they're kind of afraid of government organizations. And again, like bringing up last night's presentation of just the importance of your group developing those relationships in those communities will really help, I think, attack some of these bad actors and things like that. So just wanted to add that one more point.
Yeah, so first I'd like to say that I think the changes to the enforcement program are really good. I think that you're going to see some positive changes at the end of this when you look back on it, and appreciate the effort that went into relooking at it and making those changes. One of the challenges I think that is it's not as highlighted is the abandonment of properties and the selling quickly of properties, just trying to get away from it. I mean, I think that that's probably one of the main reasons you don't hear back from people, is they just, you know, once you get the county, Fish and Wildlife, Water Board, you have a tsunami of fines and changes and work that you have to do, and they just bail. You know, their property's not worth it. And then, so once that happens, have you guys ever, or do we have a program, or I've been out of the game for a little bit of politics. So one of the things we did at the county when you'd have like a code enforcement issue is we would go in and clean it up, and then we would put a lien on the property and get paid back when it got sold. So is there one of the challenges I see here is like you have that pipe that's running sewage into a creek, or you know something's going to fail in a pond or something. You can't wait around for someone to do it themselves because they're gone, or they've changed hands, or for whatever reason. Is there a way that we can go in and do some of the work, just to like emergency work to shore it up and then put a lien on the property so that the water quality is protected in the meantime?
We do have a cleanup and abatement account, and I will ask Yvonne to describe that further, that we can do that. But there being a statewide fund and with the multitude of demands on that, it can be difficult to utilize, especially at the scope and scale that we're talking about here. What I can say is that for those reasons you're talking about is why it supports our use of this strategy to issue claim and abatement orders quickly, and then also to progress through the process quickly so that we can then get a lien. Just to reiterate that we get to the lien after we issue a monetary penalty and somebody fails to pay that penalty, we put a lien on the property. The other thing to point out, I think is really important to emphasize, is once we issue a cleanup and abatement order on a property, it doesn't just stick with the individual. It's a function of the site conditions on the property. So if the property changes hands, new property owners are still responsible for their site conditions, and it's a relatively minor procedural thing to change the name and reissue the claim and abatement order to the new property owner. So selling the property doesn't get you out of the responsibility to clean up your site. And the CAO then, in a sense, becomes kind of a shadow on that property that is not going to go away. So those are my comments, and then I imagine Yvonne probably has some to add.
Yeah, I mean, I will just add that we do have some legal authorities. We can get inspection and abatement warrants, and we do have some authority where the state board can clean up and then seek restitution or lien a property. It is not a program that we've heavily relied on in any of our other regulatory programs. It's not a tool that we've relied on. Periodically, we'll do it in emergency situations. It would have to be more developed to use it in this program on this smaller scale, like to go in and do it. And it would require additional staff and procedures that we don't currently have in place. But we do have some legal authorities that would allow us to do it, and we could do it in like a immediately dangerous circumstance where we merited that it was worth going in and doing it, and you know, to prevent a catastrophe or some sort of like major failure. But we don't usually do it on, as Kason said, the scale and the frequency that this program would need. So leaning the properties is definitely something that we do in this program routinely, which we don't do in our other regulatory programs. We will go straight to lien as soon as something is in default. That's helpful. Carrying over cleanup and abatement orders to subsequent property owners and putting them on notice is helpful. We work with the AG's office to the extent that we can leverage other tools. If we find that someone has a multiple sites or are doing things along those lines, we find a lot of like cash transactions in the North Coast and non-recorded deeds. And like, there's a lot going on under the surface that takes a while to kind of dig into. But so they're holding people accountable and it takes a lot of work, and we're really trying to find the most efficient way to do it. And that's why we're trying to get tools where we impose realistic cleanup schedules, but expect immediate compliance or impose penalties within the same grow season, while hopefully, will help us get there before reset the expectation. The expectation when you hear from the water boards and they ask you to do something, you better do what you can as soon as you can, because there are penalties coming. And if folks are interested in maintaining a business and going from year to year, then they're more motivated to do that. If they're interested in getting into a legal situation or becoming legal in permissive counties where it's allowed, they're more motivated to do that. The transient grows are difficult, and sometimes, we have to rely on our law enforcement partners to handle those in a different way. If somebody is going to just come in and grow and run, that's something that we start looking at our other tools and our other partners for.
I'd like to ask you to consider eliminating extensions of time to expedite whatever has to be done. Mm-hmm. And so that they don't, and I've made this comment before, so that the discharger doesn't shift assets, mm-hmm. show a inability to pay, et cetera.
I appreciate that comment, and I think that's consistent with our proposed strategy. So the primary strategy element is to move more quickly through the process. When somebody fails to meet a deadline in a cleanup and abatement order, we proceed directly and immediately to a penalty. I think that is consistent with the strategy, and notwithstanding the time schedule order option, which does give more time, but that speaks to the exception piece. There are certain exceptional circumstances where if we decide to go towards a penalty on those cases, there's a lot of complicating factters, and it could be a challenging board hearing to get through all of those details. And in certain circumstances, it might make sense to give more time. But I appreciate the general rule is, and the feedback you're giving us is, let's keep that to be the exception. I appreciate that.
Board members, any comments? Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Board Chair?
Yes.
If it's all right with you, I wouldn't mind giving everyone a quick update on the earthquake and tsunami warnings, So there was a 7.0 earthquake off the coast of Eureka, and there's been more than half a dozen aftershocks, upwards of, I think, 4.2 is the strongest. There is a tsunami warning. It goes from Davenport, California, up past into Oregon. From what news I'm watching, I haven't seen any actual impacts yet, but it has supposed to have been already. The time frames would have been hitting Fort Bragg at 11:10, Crescent City 11:20, San Francisco 12:10. I have been kind of keeping an eye on the news as much as I can, and I haven't seen anything specific come through on it, but that's what I know for now. Oh, there also were the two earthquakes right near Cobb, right after the one that the 7.0, they were, I'm forgetting which was the 4.3. covers the Cobb ones. Sorry, I lost them on my map. But yeah, 5.8. It's I think that was readjusted down from there, but I can find it. So, but that's what I know as of now.
Thank you, Josh. Valerie, did you do your executive report, or was that done earlier?
In addition to the updates I provided earlier, I did want to highlight a couple of things in the written executive officer's report. I understand the board packet this time around was very lengthy, and so you may not have had the chance to look at the executive officer's report. It has some excellent articles, but the ones I wanted to highlight are that there are articles on both the Wallala River Sediment TMDL and the Russian River Pathogen TMDL. And the reason that I wanted to highlight those is they provide a little bit of a preview of items that will be coming your way soon. So we're planning a workshop on the updated Russian River Pathogen TMDL in April 2025. And so the article that's in the written report just gives a good intro to that, and might help you be more prepared for when the workshop comes. And then on the Wallala Sediment TMDL, my understanding is that we plan to release a draft of the TMDL mid-2025. We don't yet have a board workshop on the calendar yet, but just wanted to highlight those because in addition to being interesting information, they will, you know, support board members and the public being prepared for future items that come before the board. So that's it.
Thank you very much. Board members, do you have any requests for future agenda items and other items of interest?
I think we got plenty coming up.
Okay. The next meeting is 9 a.m. Wednesday, February 5th, 2025, and 9 a.m. Thursday, February 6th, 2025, and potentially third day, 9 a.m. Friday, February 7th, 2025, here at 5550 Skyline Boulevard, Santa Rosa. And with that, unless there's anything else, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.